Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to My Millennial Property with John Pidgeon. Today we're talking about all things tax and all that interesting stuff. What can we claim, not claim, capital gains tax, purchasing property in trust. So we've got Michael Jones from Altus Financial here with us today. So I'm going to ask him all these hard-hitting questions. Let's get into it. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, John. How are you going?
I am awesome, thank you. So you're a senior client advisor with Altus Financial, who we've had Scotty Young on the show before, I believe. So your details will be in the show notes. Tell us, how's life as an accountant?
At the moment, it's very busy. So obviously the last few years have been challenging for a lot of our business clients. So increased workload's been great, but more interesting work allows us to help our clients better. And obviously as times tighten over the next 12 months, I'm sure we'll be more useful and more required from our clients. But
yeah, I used to talk to accountants and think that, okay, June 30 is a deadline, it's everything's busy, don't talk to an accountant, you won't get an appointment around then. But it seems as though now it's spread across the whole 12 months.
Yeah, so it's funny actually, the quietest month of the year for us is July. July and January is when everyone takes holidays.
Yeah.
Because most of your business clients aren't really ready to do their tax or anything like that come July. It always takes a few months to get things ready.
Mm.
And it's really cash flow these days. It's all quarterly, so a lot of quarterly board meetings and things like that. So obviously have project work as well that we do during the year, and obviously helping clients in the second half of the year make sure they hit their targets and make the tax strategies in place before 30 June.
Awesome. Well, thankfully to our listener group, which has been awesome, by the way, they've put a whole range of questions in the Facebook group. So I've given you a few to run your eyes over today. So the first one from Paul Spicer, how does CGT, capital gains tax, affect different scenarios when selling investment properties? Which tax margin will it be, personal name versus PTY LTD, which is basically a company?
Yep. Great question there, Paul. Thanks for sending that one through. So CGT will affect different scenarios when selling investment properties. Which tax margin will it be, personal name versus proprietary limited? So really depends on what entity owns the property and who's going to pay the tax. So if the property is owned by a company, the company will pay the tax in its tax return. Or if I own a property in my own name and make a capital gain on that, I'll pay the tax in my personal name.
Okay, so personal name, example, 32 cents, 37 or 45. Are they the different tax brackets at the moment?
Yeah. So in my personal name, it'll depend what other income I have. So if my salary is $120,000 and then I sell an investment property, obviously the investment property gain will go on top of that 120 already. Mm-hmm. If I'm at 180, then any capital gain I make over on top of that will then start paying the top marginal tax rate of 47 cents. Well, if I was lucky enough to retire next year and waited till next year and I had no salary income, I would actually be able to pay no tax for the first approximately $22,000, pay a smaller rate up to $45,000, and then smaller rate again to a larger rate to $120,000, and it goes up and up on the scale of tax rates. So that's a consideration there. Obviously, if I own a property in my own name, I can also get a discount. So if I own a property for more than 12 months as an investment, I can get a discount on that gain. I actually only pay tax on half. So again, that's the tax rate I spoke about before, depending on where my income sits when I sell the property. Important note here from Paul's question is, if it's in a proprietary limited in a company, companies aren't eligible for a 50% discount. So a company will pay a set tax rate. Also, if companies don't have scaled income, companies pay a set rate of tax. So whether a company has $300,000 of income before it sells a property or it has zero, it'll pay a straight 30% tax rate.
Awesome. That's great. So a quick example, I'm on $140,000 and my capital gain has been $50,000. So that tips me over the 45 bracket of 180K per year bracket. So I'm paying 10 grand of tax at the 45 and the rest would be at 37. Is that right?
Yeah. So if you make a 50,000 gain and there's no discount available, or it's 100,000, you've already applied the 50%, so you only got 50,000. Yeah. So that last 10,000 will get taxed at 47%, while the 40,000 before that will be in the bracket beneath that at 34.5.
Awesome. And is there initiatives by the government to change those tax brackets? Was there a phase three or four or something of the whole promise by the Labor government?
Yeah. So at the moment, legislation states that 1st of July 24, that tax bracket will increase from 180 to 200.
Right.
They're also talking about abolishing the tax rate between 45 and 120.
Right.
So it'll just be 45 straight to 200.
There you go. So that's the majority of us out there, isn't it? I think the listener group that we've got, the average income must be like 70 or 80, I think, in the last survey.
Yeah.
So anywhere from 45 through to
200K
will
be in the same tax bracket.
Which will be?
Ooh, I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's in the 30s, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's definitely those at the top end get a benefit, I know that.
Yeah, so if between 180 and 200, you're going to kick down a bracket.
Mm.
And those that are between 120 and 180 will kick down a bracket, yeah.
Yeah, nice. Good work. Okay. Michelle Williamson, a spicy one here. I'm an accountant. When I interview accountants, my technical question is, explain depreciation to a non-finance person. You would not believe how many don't do it well on this question. So the pressure's on, Michael.
Pressure on, yeah. Thanks, Michelle, for the hard one. So depreciation. So I guess to explain the concept of what this is if you think about purchasing an air conditioner. Now, if you want to say it was $10,000 and that air conditioner is going to last you 10 years, the idea as a business or I guess as an investor is it's not really a $10,000 expense incurred this year because you're going to get the benefit of that for 10 years. So depreciation is an accounting term. While you paid the $10,000 out this year, you haven't really made a $10,000 expense this year because you're going to get the benefit for 10 years. So in simple terms, you actually claim as a deduction or a depreciation expense of $1,000 every year for 10 years. What that does is it spreads the cost of that asset out over the effective life of the asset. So you get that benefit for 10 years, you recognise 1/10 of the expense. Now in practical terms in tax, what we're actually able to do is they call it the diminishing value. We're actually able to claim more upfront. So rather than claim $1,000 each year for 10 years, we can actually claim $2,000 the first year and then reduces and reduces each year. So by the end of the last year, you're only claiming $60. You do claim $10,000 all, but the idea is generally for tax, we like to claim as much upfront as we can because we want to save you the money now rather than save you down the track.
Okay, great. So expanding on from business to investment properties, for example, when we let's go to the top end of depreciation or maximum depreciation is buying something or building something brand new, and the build cost is $350,000. We can't claim the whole $350,000 over the next 30 years of existence, can we?
So the build cost of $350,000 would be considered like capital works. So usually it's 2.5% at a fixed rate over 40 years.
Okay. All right, Kylie Haynes says, can you please get Michael to explain that accountants can't actually get people a bigger refund? It is based on what your expenses are. Accountants can't make up deductions. Now, what's Kylie on about here, Mick?
Yeah, so I can't see in Kylie's frustration here is whenever a client has a tax bill, it's usually my fault, not theirs. So I can understand that. So I think it's important to note that if you give 100 accountants the same information, 99 will get you the same result. You know, assume that one makes a mistake, whether it's a good one or a bad one. What a good accountant can do, though, is ask you good questions and prompt you to make better deductions. So that can be one of two things. One, just asking good questions and getting answers, things like working from home, or how much you use your telephone, they're kind of the easy ones, but also to prompt you to record expenses, things like motor vehicle. So motor vehicle is multiple ways you can claim. Usually the most tax effective, if it's correct and appropriate, is the logbook method. The logbook method allows you to record for 12 weeks how you use your car for work and then claim a tax deduction for that. So if you use it 40% for work and 60% personal, you can claim 40% of your fuel, your insurance, if there's interest on a loan, 40% of depreciation, as we spoke about before. As opposed to that, if you don't keep records, that option's off the table. And you can't backdate a logbook. So you can only claim things like an estimate of kilometres, and that's capped at 5,000 kilometres. So if you drive 20,000 kilometres a year and 50% is for work, that's 10,000 kilometres of expenses you've incurred. But if you don't have a logbook, you can only claim up to 5,000 as an estimate. So a good accountant can ask you questions and prompt you, in particular for investments, things like recommending quantity surveyor reports, in terms of deductibility on interest. So that advice can be given before you purchase a property is usually more helpful as well. So a good accountant helps you by prompting you with good questions and good record keeping.
And to finish off on that, you as a client want to ask good questions of the accountant as well, don't you? And one of these is from Krithi saying, is the fee for a buyer's agent for an investment property tax deductible?
So the fee for a buyer's agent, unfortunately, isn't tax deductible in the year you purchase a property. It gets added to the capital cost base. So what that means is you get a benefit of that when you dispose of the property, but you don't get the benefit up front.
Okay, Krithi, sorry to hear that, but you can claim it. It's just a bit of delayed gratification.
Yeah, so it comes off, it's added to the cost base. So when you sell the property, and if you make a $100,000 gain on the property after the 50% discount, and then you paid $5,000 for the buyer's agent, you only pay tax on $95,000.
Perfect. Not sure where we'd find a 5K BA out there, but it may happen, you know. All right. One more before we hit a break. Sharon, and you've spoken about depreciation schedules before, but let's go a little bit deeper here. Sharon Clements says, should I get a depreciation schedule done or can my accountant work out the depreciation cost at tax time?
Yeah, so it's obviously a property by property basis. But I have yet to see a depreciation schedule cost more than the benefit it's provided. So usually you can ring up a quantity surveyor and get a quote and they'll give you an idea, maybe not on the spot, but over the next week or so, they'll contact you. And if they don't think that it's going to be beneficial, they usually won't ask to do one.
Yeah, and I've found that in my experience as well. And most of them will say, look, if we can't get you more of a benefit, yeah, they obviously won't charge you or would tell you up front. They look at the house online or whatever.
Yeah, they look at it online. They look up its build year and things like that and they make an educated decision.
Yeah. So in short, Sharon, no, the accountant won't be doing your depreciation schedule for you. They simply get the quantity surveyor's report and put that or include that into your total tax return.
Yeah. And important note on that too is if you get a quantity surveyor's report this year and then in 2-3 years you spend more money on the property then, depending what it is, I wouldn't necessarily go get a new quantity surveyor's report. So if you installed a $10,000 air conditioner, you wouldn't engage a quantity surveyor to come out again. The accountant can then calculate the depreciation on that one asset.
Okay, yeah. And generally depreciation schedules were 30 years. Now I think they're 40 years, aren't they?
Yes.
Which is a long time, probably longer than when you would actually own the property for. So a quick bit of advice on that is when you buy the property, get the depreciation schedule done then. Don't hang off until June 24 and think, yeah, I'll get it done before tax time. When we purchase property, we're in the mode of admin and getting a tenant in and doing all those back-end bookwork thingies. Let's just order the depreciation schedule then at the same time and then you've got it, flick it through to your accountant and then it's in their hands.
Yep.
All right, let's take a break and we'll come back with more questions.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. We also have a panel of trusted mortgage brokers we can connect you with to get you into your first home, an investment property purchase, or to review your current loan if you don't have a broker. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right, so we're back. Corinna Fullerton says, what records should I be keeping for an investment property to make claiming deductions easier?
Great question there, Corinna. I would say for the start, just keep a record of everything you can. The reason is, as an accountant, I would prefer someone to send me 40 things, with 10 being non-tax deductible and only 30 tax deductible, than to send me 28 and miss two. So it's part of my job to make sure to take out those that can't be claimed, and to educate my clients on what can and cannot be claimed. The more information I have from you, the better. So the things that I would be keeping: council rates, obviously any interest on loans, any improvements to the property. Well, might not be a tax deduction in the year, can be an improvement and can claim depreciation in the future, repairs and maintenance, advertising for tenants. Obviously, if you have a property agent managing the property for you, they will keep this for you and can actually do a lot of disbursements and pay the council rates and things for you, often at a charge, but can make life easier for you at tax time. But I would just always say everything you can keep, and a good accountant will knock back what they can't, but educate you on what you should be keeping.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And I think you're right in the sense that the property manager should give you a financial statement at the end if they're worth their weight in gold, which has a breakdown of everything for that year. So your total income, all your total expenses, and a breakdown of what those expenses were. And you're almost simply just handing that to your accountant plus what you've paid for out of your own pocket. And that's what I like the beauty of having a property manager is, because if you get them to pay all the bills, they're also inadvertently doing all your accounting for you or your admin for you at the same time. The only thing they're probably not doing is is getting your interest from your bank loans.
Yeah, so the good property manager, we simply get the financial statement from them at the year end. And also it's a good way for you to check, and you can see what the rent was each month going up, you'd hope. And you obviously can see the gaps in your income as well, which can give you a bit of idea of why cash flow might have been a bit harder in some months than others. But really what happens after that, usually if we have a good financial statement from the property manager, is we simply make an adjustment for three things: interest, land tax, and depreciation.
Yeah, awesome. And just roll in there, a bit of a side question, the whole land tax thing. A lot of new investors don't really understand what it is. It's a state-based tax where if you go over the certain land value of threshold, you'll start to pay land tax as a percentage on that land ownership each year. Now, excludes your principal place of residence. But where do we get to in respect to land tax? Like, as an accountant, do you have that conversation with them, or should a good accountant be having that conversation about diversification within the portfolio?
In terms of the portfolio, as in for land tax considerations or...?
Yeah, just seeing if you pick up a land tax amount applied for tax purposes, right, that they've had to pay land tax throughout the year. Because what we're seeing is land tax has actually become a really important part of someone's portfolio, because the land value has gone up considerably in the last couple of years. So all of a sudden, new investors are getting these land tax bills in their mailbox, right?
Yeah, so it's important to note that land tax isn't the value of the property. It's the value of the land underneath decided by the New South Wales Inspector General.
Or any other state.
Yeah, you're correct, or any other state. So you don't get a lot of control in it. What has happened in the last 2 years, I've seen more of in the last 2 years and probably the last 15, is people actually pushing back and trying to get revaluations done or reassessments on their land tax values. Why has that happened? Because land values have skyrocketed, obviously, in the last few years, and state governments are obviously wanting the bigger piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of taking land tax into consideration in buying investment properties, a big one is on structure. So individuals have a certain threshold that can change in different states where you don't have to pay land tax, or you pay land tax at a reduced rate. So for instance, in New South Wales, trusts don't get that threshold, neither do companies, but individuals do. I'm not sure, each state has its own rules, but that can be consideration on what entity you purchase a property in. And yes, as land tax values go up, or land tax expense goes up on land values, it would be an important factor to consider against your expected rental income.
Awesome. Yeah. So, and again, extension from that question is, when would a property investor start to have a conversation with their accountant around buying entity? Because they might be either a first-time investor, or they might just simply have their owner-occupier home and want to grab some equity and go and buy something else for investment purposes. So how early on in that process would they have that chat with someone like yourself?
So probably depend how good the relationship is. I like to think my clients would approach me pretty early rather than after the fact. It's always easy to provide advice and assistance before the purchase is made. Usually it's a strategy that's been in play for 12 to 18 months, I find, before someone actually makes a purchase. Those time frames shortened in recent years because I think there was a lot of panic in the market when prices were going up and up and up. People wanted to get in before it was too late. Now that attitude's kind of slowed a little bit. We're finding more and more people giving more advice or more notice on their strategies involving that. So typically I think most people kind of start to think once they've got equity in their house, that they know that they're not going to have to pay lender's mortgage insurance, they can afford to then go fund an investment property, they usually start talking about it about 12 months out.
Okay. And would generally most people that you see buy property in their personal name as opposed to a trust or a company or something?
In terms of their first investment property, I'd say 9 out of 10 would buy in their own names or shared names with their spouses. In terms of trusts, once people start reaching a certain threshold or owning multiple properties, they start thinking about the next generation and how they pass it down. Trusts become more and more popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so on the whole personal name ownership, you've got what's called joint tenants and tenants in common as options, haven't you?
Yes.
And so a lot of clients, when we're speaking to them about strategy and whose name's going to be on the title and whose name's going to be in the loan is necessarily irrelevant for ownership purposes. It's just getting the money, right? But from an ownership point of view, most commonly it would be if there's two people, husband and wife or partners, they would be 50-50, either joint tenants and tenants in common. Can you just quickly explain the difference there?
Yeah, so tenants in common becomes quite popular for two people who've come together. Typically when you see it is when they have kids from prior relationships. And while they're together as a couple and they share that home and want to have mutual benefit of it, what they don't want is in the event one of them passes, therefore the survivor, their estate has the entire property and their children. So if my wife and I had two kids each to prior relationships, and if she passes away before me, why should my two kids get the benefit of that in the estate and not hers?
Sure. Okay. So that way they would go down the path of tenants in common, but traditionally it defaults to joint tenants, yeah?
Yeah, typically it's joint tenants, and in that case you both just own the property for mutual benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people don't understand this, but you can choose the percentage of ownership, can't you? So you could be joint tenants 99% to me and 1% to you, for example.
Yeah, and why a lot of people did that, it was became very popular about 10 years ago, was the idea being that I'll use my wife for example again, if it's 99% me and 1% her, and we have it's positively geared, this property, it's making money, it makes $10,000 a year. Well, $9,900 appears in my tax return and $100 appears in hers. Now, if I'm at a lower tax rate than her, then therefore I'm paying less tax. Now, the question would be, why not have all $10,000 in my name? Well, the reason would be if we have 1% in Rhiannon's name and 99% in my name, we can actually use Rhiannon's earning as well to help contribute to the loan. So in terms of financing, they can look at Rhiannon's salary and my salary in terms of meeting the debt requirements.
Yeah. So generally speaking, you can be on the title but not be on the loan. But if you're on the loan, you need to be on the title.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So Talia has a curly one. Would they recommend purchasing investment properties in trusts? And if not, how do you continue to get lending in personal names?
Great question there, Talia. Thanks for sending that one in. So it's important to note that trusts are actually governed by state law. So trusts are different in every state, as is land tax. So when the idea of purchasing an investment property in a trust, it is a popular strategy, and I've got many clients that have done that. It really comes down to your particular circumstances. So things to consider are, one, the cost to set up a trust. So you have to set up a trust, it can cost somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000, depending on the state you're in. And there's actually government charges on that. So for instance, in New South Wales, it's approximately $550 is a state stamp duty paid on establishing the trust. The second thing is you actually have ongoing compliance requirements. So a trust is its own entity and actually has to lodge its own tax return every year. So if I have a trust or property in a trust, I have to do an extra tax return, which is an extra cost to an accountant to do a trust every year. So that has to be weighed up against any benefits. So you might be wondering, why do some people own properties in trusts? The idea behind, usually they do it in a discretionary trust or commonly referred to as a family trust. The benefit of this can be is that income can be distributed out to different family members within the household in different years. So you can obviously try to pick tax beneficial beneficiaries every year, and that can actually change from year to year. So if, for instance, you've got a couple and then one retires 3 years earlier than the other, for 3 years there, you'd expect the one that's not working to receive the taxable distribution from the trust for the rental property.
Yeah, okay. So what that really bleeds to is understanding what the next 5 or 10 years look like, doesn't it? And before you buy that property, just really having an idea as to how long you're going to keep this property. Like we've done some developments in the past where we've had it in a unit trust, knowing full well that in 2 to 3 years' time, we're going to offload that and move that on. It has the ability to distribute the income various ways within the unit trust. Whereas if it was in our personal name, it might be a different story if it was going to be a long-term buy and hold.
Yeah, correct. There's a good point there too. With being a trust, you are still eligible for the capital gains discount of 50%. So earlier, Paul's question referring to proprietary limited a company, you don't get the CGT discount. Well, a trust still does allow you to get that CGT discount that an individual would get, which is why property in trust is more popular than property in companies.
Yeah, there you go. Interesting stuff. Hey, we don't want to get too deep on this, and we were just starting to. And for the real property nerds out there listening in, if you want something deeper, we can do a deeper episode where we do go into the weeds on all of this, because you could talk for days on trust structures and setups and asset protection and tax minimization, I suppose, or maximization, depending on how you look at it.
Well, tax maximization is not something I'm familiar with.
Yeah. But I suppose from an investment point of view, tax is the secondary almost byproduct / benefit of investing. We don't go out with the sole purpose to minimise my tax with this investment. I'm buying that investment to get some cash flow from it or to get some capital growth from it. If I can get some tax benefits along the journey, then that's an added benefit to property investing, isn't it?
Yeah, correct. And that's obviously where like financial planners and things can come into play as well and help you out, work out your strategy. What do I require? Do I require capital growth or do I need cash flow? You know, a 25 roll and a 55 roll are going to have different answers to those questions. Mm. But yeah, tax is always the afterthought. So it's, you know, we want to make sure we're involved in the conversations and make sure we can put it in place, but you don't pick assets for tax deductions.
No, yeah. And there was a question there at the end from Christine, I believe, and we'll finish off in this one. Depreciation schedules, when to get them done, new properties, fully furnished, etc. And we know that the maximum depreciation is on new properties, isn't it? So it's not a question that you necessarily need to answer because we've already sort of done it, but it just reminded me that they are maximum in their tax deductions with the high depreciation, but we've got to ensure that the asset's going to be right for us first and foremost before we just go and say, oh, we'll just go and buy brand new or build brand new just to get the depreciation.
Yeah, correct. And another trap there can be with if you spend an extra $50,000 thinking about the depreciation schedule. Well, if you're borrowing the money, that extra $50,000 doesn't cost you $50,000 in the end. I'm about interest on top of it as well, and the length of the loan, you've paid a lot more than $50,000 for it. For a depreciation expense, you don't get the benefit in the first year.
Mm. Yeah, interesting stuff. Okay. All right, Michael James, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
No worries at all. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for answering those questions. So, if you want to hook up with Michael, Altus Financial, the link will be in the show notes there. Hopefully you've all got something out of that. I know I did. Thanks for allowing us into your ears and lives and everything else. Thanks again for those that submitted questions in the Facebook group. Apologies to those who we didn't get to today. That may be an episode 2 for us down the track, but look forward to chatting to you soon.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
Taking your property journey to the next level starts with education.
That's why we make this podcast, but we've also created online courses to equip you with the knowledge you need to take the next steps.
I've created the Solvair Online Academy, open to both first home buyers and seasoned investors, where I share my tips and experience from 20 years in the property space.
And if you're a first home buyer, I have the course just for you. Everything from pre-approval all the way through into your settlement and everything in between. How to place an offer, how to bid at auction, what to even look for at an open home, and what questions to ask the agents. It's all covered in my online course.
Follow the links in the show notes to sign up and get started today.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.